This is Roberto. You are back with another Steambox Versus podcast. Today, we are with my steampunks at Highlander. Steampunks at Highlander, say what's popping?
What's poppin'?
Yeah. We have guests today from Gonzalez Law. Professor Deborah Gonzalez is in the house. Hi, Deb.
Hey.
And advocate, lawyer, he was a judge, he's my dad. He was an okay dad. He was an all right dad. When it came time to eat, he was tricky. Roberto Gonzalez is here. Hey, Pop.
Hey, guys.
All right. And leading the crew, right? Leading the steampunks. Everybody said today is Sylvia's day. Why is it Sylvia's day?
Because Sylvia's really big on immigration.
You love immigration.
Yes, I am very big.
You love people traveling to other countries.
Yes, and I'm very big on America opening up their borders and hopefully accepting people, whether if they have it in their hearts too, and see how they fit into our economy and our communities.
Okay. All right. Deb, you're giving her the power fist. The power is that.
Preach it, sister.
Preach it, sister.
If you see Sylvia in her other classes, whenever we talk about immigration on classwork, you can see she got that passion in her eyes. She lights
it's
up.
It's real.
It's honestly for real. She's very passionate about it, and
she gets happy when we talk about it. She gets so into it. She just wants to keep talking.
Before we started this podcast here, I was working with this school on some design stuff, and Sylvia was on the team, and when that came up, I saw what you're talking about. I saw her passion, and I was like, man, when we start this podcast, I've got a guest for you. So our guest is here. Who has a question for our guests? Let me know who you're directing it to. Ask your question, and if you're on the ends, make sure you're nice and loud and clear.
I'm directing this to Roberto. So you being the first Latino judge of Rhode Island, how was your upbringing? What struggles did you have to go through to get to where you were today?
Wow. How much time do we have?
You went right into the deep end.
So I had a pretty normal upbringing. I grew up, I grew up in New York City. My family moved here to Rhode Island when I was a teenager. I did pretty good in school, and everybody was encouraging me. Counselors, teachers, to go for it, to do something, big with my life.
You went to one of those elite high schools, right?
I did. I got lucky. Because I was growing up. I mean, you could tell by my gray hair that I'm a product of the '60s. Even though I was born in the '50s, but I grew up in the '60s, and of course, we just celebrated Monday, Martin Luther King. Holiday, and Martin Luther King was very active back then. There were a lot of civil rights movements going on across the country, marches, and a lot of opportunities started to open up for people of color. So I got lucky. The high school that I went to was just about an all-white boys high school in New York City. No one back then dreamed about getting into that school if they were black or Latino. And as a result of the civil rights movement, the school agreed to take in a number of people of color. So I was in that group. So I got very lucky, and I got a solid educational foundation. And then from there, when I came here, I went to college. I thought I wanted to be an engineer back then, but I quickly learned that my talents and my desires were to work with people, mm-hmm. and that was my passion, working with people. And back in back here in Rhode Island in the early 70s, there weren't many Latinos. Not like it is now. If I tell you I went to Central High School and I was one of six Latino students in a school that now is predominantly Latino, it's pretty hard to imagine what it was like. And it was myself, my brother, and a few other people that I still stay in touch with. We had to stay together, to watch each other's backs and help each other. And that's what we did. Anyway, from there, I went to college. I took up social work in college because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work with people. But then, you know, I realized that, you know, why stop there? Mm-hmm. And so I have my family, my first, Robert here.
I'm the first.
And then,
you hear that? You hear that, brother?
And
eat that.
And so, you know, I wasn't in a position to go right into law school.
Yeah.
So I put it off a good 10 years, but I never put it off in my mind. I knew that that's what, you know, that I wanted to go to law school because I figured that with a law degree, I can do so much more than I could with doing the social work. Mm-hmm. You know, and social work is great. For anyone that wants to get into it, please do. I mean, I encourage you. But, you know, if you want to do something, you know, further, and that's what I wanted, I had that urge to get a law degree, and I did it. You know, it wasn't easy. Yes.
So how does it feel with you being the first Latino judge in Rhode Island that not only you're inspiring Latinos in Rhode Island, but, you know, people who reach your store, you could possibly be inspiring people around the country. How does that feel to you?
Well, you know, it feels good to know that, not so much that, you know, that I was the first, but to know that I opened doors for others that followed.
That bench has it been exclusively Latino after you left?
Well, it hasn't, because there's in that court, it was the Providence Housing Court that I was a judge in. There's three judges,
okay.
But there's almost always been at least one Latino judge since me, including, you know, some
the mayor followed you.
Right, including Angel Tavares, who went on to be mayor of the city of Providence and ran for governor.
Yep.
And Jorge Lorza, the present mayor of Providence, was also on that bench. And now Dione Garcia, who is, I think, involved with Steambox.
Dione Garcia
board.
Is one of the board members for Steambox.
So you know, I think I like to believe that I had a little something to do with that. And so I opened that door, and that makes me feel good. I mean, if I tell you the truth, I really wasn't looking to be a judge. I wasn't. In fact, I kind of got dragged into it because the community wanted me to do it, you know, the Latino community. When I was approached about the judgeship, and I said, I'm not interested, people said, what? How can you turn that down? You know, it's like the most prestigious job. You know, and quite honestly, I was satisfied helping people, doing what I did best, which was, you know, defending people, keeping people from getting deported, helping people bring their families to the United States. And that was that is still my passion today. But I took on the judgeship at the urging of members of the community. Mm-hmm. And so the rest is history. I mean, you know, I served 12 years. I became chief judge of the court, which was it's an awesome honor. You know, it's strange to go places and be referred to as your honor everywhere you go, your honor. And to be introduced, you know, if you go to a dinner or a function, wherever, you know, you get introduced along with the governor.
They
are exactly. So, yeah, there was quite a bit of prestige that I wasn't looking for. But
so listening to this, right? Like, and I can validate particularly the latter half, right? Like, but listening to this, that was the sweet story of the sainthood, right? Like, and again, I can validate that, right? Like, there's a lot of good dude in there. There's a lot of noble intent. But what were the struggles like, right? Like, were you ever a bad dude? Like, did that happen?
Listen, I was, you know...
Pardon the interruption. Calvin Doe, please report to the main office for dismissal.
Calvin has to go to the office. Calvin's not here.
Okay, I was a pretty normal teenager. You know, I did, you know, the kinds of things that most teenagers do. I was never in any serious trouble, you know, like I wasn't arrested or, you know, or anything like that. But, you know, I have friends that were, you know, so I grew up with people that did do things. So, you know, walking the line and knowing, you know, when not to do the wrong thing was very important in my life.
That's the narrative that he's going to give the podcast. Tell me more. So we have his wife here, Professor Deb Gonzalez. Tell me more.
I did not know him during his younger years, but I've heard some stories, man, that are not as, you know, sweet and clean as we're hearing.
The gangs
weren't
red and blue.
Today.
They were Jets and Sharks, and the gangs used to dance in New York City
and
stuff
younger.
Like that.
You look young right now.
All right, all right. You know, but I, you know, I heard
I'll show you guys clippings of the cars that he wrapped around trees.
Yeah. Listen, yes, I had a...
In my time with him, I've known of a couple of those.
All right.
Yeah, I did have a passion for cars that, you know, I kind of regret. That's one of the things that I regret now. You know, I don't know. You know, when you grow up, you're going to look back on your, you know, your teenage years and you're going to say, I wish I hadn't done that. You know, maybe that kind of took away from, you know, from some of the other things that I could have done. I spent a lot of money on cars, race cars, you know, because that was my thing back then. And I wish I hadn't done that.
Hit me. You must be burning.
Yeah, what? Passing the Sylvia.
Okay, so, Judge, for me, I know, like, I really want to go into the same line of work you're in, but I want to know, do people, like, around the same, in, like, your professional setting, do they think you're biased to helping, like, undocumented people?
Absolutely.
That's a good question.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, when you're a lawyer, you have to be biased towards your client, okay? You have to take your client's side. Mm-hmm. And if your client is the immigrant, then, you know, you're going to try to help the immigrant, and you're going to go up against some of the people that are anti-immigrant. And there's a lot of them.
Yes.
You know, there are people that are afraid of immigrants. There are people that, you know, think immigrants are taking their jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, that we don't have enough natural resources and that immigrants are coming and taking, you know? So, yeah, if you are confronted by one of these people, you have to be biased on the other side. And I've had some experiences, you know, that weren't so pretty. And in fact, you were at one of them when we were trying to get in-state tuition for undocumented mm-hmm. immigrants. And for those of you that don't know what that is, if back it's been over 10 years now, if you were not a U.S. citizen or permanent resident, if you were undocumented and you wanted to go to college, you had to pay out-of-state tuition, which is three times the normal tuition to go to a state college or university or the community college.
Despite being a resident.
Despite living in Rhode Island all your life. You know, if you were born in Mexico and your parents brought you here when you were only months old, you had to pay that out-of-state tuition. So kids, you know, they couldn't go.
Yeah.
So we fought hard to change that, and when in that process, you were at that meeting at community college, weren't you?
Probably. Yeah. I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
And it got real ugly because the anti-immigrant groups were very well organized, and they came out shouting, you know, all kind of, you know, profanities and, you know, go back home, and a bunch of wetbacks, and, you know, all these insulting comments, and we had.
Pardon the interruption, Myla. Please report to the main office for dismissal.
So we had to walk into that arena and you know and say why we support in face of that. So yes, you have to be biased at times.
I've seen Deb like sometimes we'll play games. Sometimes it'll be an argument over family dinner. You guys have all had family dinner where an argument comes up.
I know.
Deb will argue whatever side Deb feels like arguing on this thing. So I'm sure Deb knows that. Like, but what's the line, right? Like. So do you agree that you've got to be biased towards your client, like on behalf of your client?
I think you need to be ride or die with your client. Like if I have a client that I'm representing, I'm going to be ride or die until I think the client wants me to go down a road that I can't go down for whatever reason that might be. So I'm ride or die to the extent that what the client is doing is morally right. And to the extent that I'm not going to jeopardize my law license.
Mm.
Yeah.
So to the extent that I'm not doing that, then I'm all in.
Yeah, lawyers are bound by ethical rules,
right.
You know, so you can't do things that are against the law or are morally wrong.
But not take a case, right? Like you can...
Well, you can decide which cases you want to take. I mean, I have that option.
So
not every lawyer
O.J. Simpson
does.
Walks into your office... Not an immigration case, obviously, but...
Yeah.
And
I've said no to plenty of cases.
Yep.
I've had clients who've come to me. Now, unlike him, he's in private practice, so he takes cases so long as clients can pay because he needs to make a living. I, on the other hand, teach at a clinic, so we take cases pro bono for free.
Yeah.
So I could say, and he can too... most people I don't say no to because it's not about the money, but it's about, you know, what is it that that client's trying to accomplish? Can I ethically continue to do that and then bring forward the client's goals? Because at the end of the day, it's what does the client want to do? But many times I've either fired clients after they've been with me because they want me to do something I don't agree with, or because the client and I don't see eye to eye for some reason, or in many instances, because I'm biased. So, you know, we've talked about, well, we have never talked about it. I talk about being biased with my students all the time. And, you know, even though I'm Latina too, I still have my own biases that I bring to the table. And so if there is a bias there that I can't work out, and it's happened to me, then I have to let the client go, because then I can't do my job as the lawyer to bring forward the client's goals.
So obviously you can't be biased, for example, against, let's say, all Chinese people, okay? Because, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, that's the kind of bias that you shouldn't have in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if you're an immigration lawyer, you know? But to give you an example, let's say a couple walks in and they say, oh, we just got married and my wife is undocumented and I want to get her legal in this country, right? And then during the course of the conversation with the couple, I find out that they only married to get a green card,
mm-hmm.
okay, which is illegal. Now, I am ethically required not to bring their case forward. The minute they tell me it's not a real marriage, I have to tell them, look, I can't take your case. Right? So that's an example of cases that, you know, we have to not help someone commit a crime or do something that's unlawful.
Does that mean they shouldn't tell you?
Well, that's a good point. So I've actually, you know, had situations where I explained to the client, look, you told me that this isn't a good marriage. And the client will say, well, you mean if I hadn't told you this, you'd be able to take my client? I said, well, yeah, you might want to remember that if you go see another lawyer, you know? Mm. But, yeah, I'm not supposed to help them commit a crime, okay?
Thank you for, so you. He gave me the motion. He remembered, we talked about this. We only had 1 week to prepare for this stuff. But you gave me the motion that let me know that you have another question. Don't forget, if you have a question and you're ready to jump in, give me this kind of thing, make sure I see you, and I will come to you, but go ahead.
Yeah, a serious thing I wanted to ask. It's fine if you don't know, but in this day and age of immigration, what happens to them? I want to know about children specifically. What happens to the children?
Will you take that question and expand on it? Because last week you asked, was that you that asked the question about children at the border?
So at the border, from the border of Texas and Mexico, when the children are separated from their family and the parents go to one prison and the children go to another detention center, what is the legal process there? What is that called and what happens to those children?
I think Debbie is better equipped to answer that because she's going down to the border in 2 months to represent those kinds of situations.
And I was there. So under the Obama administration, family separation was already happening, right? Or family detention was already happening. And what happens to the kids, so your question specifically, Sylvia, was what's happening to the kids? What's the process called? The process... I'm not going to say what the process is called because we're on recording and you guys are kids.
What you call the process?
What I call the process, yeah. I am not going to say here today. But what they're doing essentially and what they did, because presumably, you know, although I don't believe anything this administration says, they have claimed to stop separating mothers and children. But what was happening under that policy, if it's no longer happening today, was that mothers would come in with their kids. And there's a law, it's called the Trafficking Victims Reauthorization Act of 2008, that says that children who are coming to the United States can't be deported. So they can't deport the kids, they have to allow them to come in and find a way in order for them to be able to fight their case, but they can't just summarily deport the kid. So what they would do is they would put these kids in shelters. Somewhat like a DCYF home, if any of you have heard of the Department of Children, Youth, and Services that separates kids, even in Rhode Island, right? That's kind of what they're doing is that they're putting these kids in a shelter, and in the shelter, you know, the kids are provided with an education and they're provided with medical care and food and shelter, but they're separated from their moms and dads. And so what was happening to mom or dad is that mom or dad would then get arrested for the crime of coming in without proper documents, being charged with a federal crime and going to federal prison, serving about 30 days, and then being put back into immigration prison, and then being deported while the kids were still here without ever connecting the kid back to the parent. And so from what I understand, I think there's still about 600 children who've never been connected back with their parent. And so those kids are either living in foster care or hopefully they've been connected with some family member. I, for one, have a client at my clinic right now who was separated from her mom. Mom was deported, was arrested, charged with the crime, deported back to the home country. The little girl was brought to Rhode Island to live with her aunt. Dad ended up coming, which is unrelated to mom's coming. But that's pretty much what happened. Now the child, she's seven, she's probably eight now, is now in deportation proceedings. So now we have to figure out what it is that we're going to do to kind of get her to stay.
I've seen video of children, like, are children supposed to represent themselves? Is that, like, I've seen...
So I teach the immigration clinic at the law school, and what that means is law students come to my clinic, and I teach them how to be lawyers, and with that... We have real cases, so it's not just a classroom. Like, they go to court, we're lawyers. And I show a movie called Icebox that HBO put out. If you guys are ever interested, have you seen the movie?
I've seen it.
So that's legit what's happening. So Sylvia's seen the movie, and the movie starts off with this kid who's being persecuted by gang members. I think it's supposed to be the 18th Street Gang, for those of you who are familiar with them. And he was from, I think, Honduras. He was either from Honduras or El Salvador.
I don't know if he was Honduras.
And so he gets to his parents send him away. I think he was 13 at the time. And he gets to the border, and the officer at the border is asking him if he's afraid to go back. And clearly he's afraid because the gang had been persecuting him, torturing him. And the officer asks him, he gives him what is a legal document, asks him to read the document and sign it. And then that boy alone shows up in court. That's not uncommon, and that's real. I've been to court in Boston. I remember one time I was there with my students. We had finished our case, but we were just observing. And this little girl, she had to be, I don't know, five or six. She had little pigtails. She had, little kids wear patent leather shoes with frilly socks. For those of us who are girls, maybe y'all did that too when you were kids. And she legit walked up there by herself. The only person that was with her was a volunteer person from KIND, which is a nonprofit organization called Kids in Need of Defense. And she went up there as a friend of the court, which people can do, and asked the court for another date so that she could find a lawyer. But legit, this kid was five. She had no idea what was going on there, other than the fact that she looked cute in a really pretty dress with frilly socks.
And that happens across the country, particularly around the border states. You see that.
Go ahead.
To the judge, I want to know how the immigrants' positivity affect our economic.
So, immigrants.
Good question.
So yes, very good question. You know, first of all, ask yourself why do immigrants come here? You know, why did if you come from immigrant parents or grandparents, and we all do at some point, right? Unless we're Native American. So why do they come here? So some people come here to work. They come here because they can't get a job, they can't get ahead. They come here sometimes to escape persecution, the kid in Honduras. There's gangs, there's violence. They come here because there's corruption in their country, and they can't get ahead no matter how hard they work. They come here because in their country there may have been a natural disaster such as drought, a hurricane, that's what happened with a lot of the Salvadorans and Hondureños that came here. But anyway, there's a lot of reasons why people come. But once they're here, they all have to work. Nobody's going to give them handouts and say, here, go sit at home and learn English or watch TV or whatever. They have to work. So just by the mere fact that they're working, they're making a positive contribution to our economy. People that work pay taxes. You know, whether or not they work under the table, and I want to be very clear because this is a common misconception. It's always thrown into our faces.
What does it mean to work under the table?
Okay, so it's something that's always thrown into our faces by the anti-immigrant group. So, you know, oh, immigrants don't pay taxes. They don't pay taxes because, you know, they work under the table. What does that mean? Well, it means that they're getting paid in cash. Mm-hmm. You know, so they go and they do the landscaping and, you know, you give them a check or money in cash and there's no taxes taken out, okay? But that person then takes his money, right, and he spends it. And guess what? When you go to Walmart or to Stop and Shop, there's no line that says no taxes for undocumented immigrants, okay? Mm-hmm. So they have to get in the same line that everybody else gets in, and they pay sales tax, right? When they buy gas, it's the same thing. They pay taxes on their gas, you know? So in fact, many of them work with taxes being taken out. You know, even though they may not have a Social Security number, sometimes they make up a number. Or sometimes they get a taxpayer identification number, and the employer can then take out taxes. Well, not only do they take out taxes, but they also take out money for Social Security. And guess what? They can't take Social Security benefits unless they are permanent resident of a U.S. citizen. So that money goes into something called a suspended fund, which is somewhere in the tune of about $10 billion now that the government is holding on to. Because it you know, they can't identify a proper Social Security number. So yes, they make a contribution. They make a contribution in the community. You know, whether it's by you know, Little League, whether it's by going to church, whether you know it's by you know cleanup day in the community. I mean, all of those things are things that immigrants do, whether or not they're legal or illegal. So there's a lot of economic activity and a lot of contributions being made. Now, the anti-immigrant groups will point out, well, you know, they put their kids in school and our schools are overwhelmed with undocumented kids and they're not, you know, they're not paying enough to cover the, you know, the cost of an education. They get sick, they go to the hospital. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, and there's plenty of studies on this if you want to, you know, go and do some research on it, is that immigrants go to the hospitals and see doctors less often than citizens and permanent residents. Okay?
So the Economic Progress Institute, which is a nonprofit organization in the state of Rhode Island that does studies relating
Economic
to
Progress Institute. Okay.
Did a study recently that shows, based on census numbers and studies that have been done, oh my God, what's the name of that foundation that does a lot of studies? Oh my God, I can't remember. But
the Pew?
Pew Research Foundation, that says that there are approximately 3,000 undocumented immigrants in the state of Rhode Island. No, excuse me, 30,000 undocumented immigrants in the state of Rhode Island, and that immigrants, the undocumented population alone, contributes $31 million to our economy per year. So imagine that's $1 million per undocumented person per year. So just, I think that's quite significant.
So that isn't making a big change in our economy, basically.
Sure, if you were to take in all undocumented immigrants and remove them from this country tomorrow, our economy would collapse.
It would collapse really bad.
Yeah, no question about it. Yeah. And you know, nobody's advocating for that. Even the, you know, the most ardent anti-immigrant groups, you know, they realize that they need, you know, their housekeepers, that they need their lawns maintained, that, you know, the hotels need their chambermaids and bellhops. And they realize that without these people, that their life would become so much more expensive, because now they're going to have to pay more for these employees, and if they can find them.
I'm sorry, I forgot. Was it Deborah?
Yes.
I don't want to go all the way back, but I have to ask it. So you said that you went down to the border and worked. How heartbreaking is it to see that children are being taken away from their parents, because we always hear about it, but we never see it. It's probably different than seeing it, than hearing about it.
So I went twice already. This is going to be my third time going when I go in March. When I went the first time, it was 2015 under the Obama administration, and at that time, so they weren't separating families, but they were detaining kids in prisons. And so I'm a mom. I have a daughter. Rob's not my son, but he's like my son, kind of not really.
He just got this on.
Yeah, I think I got this on.
He's all right. So as a mother, I remember when I was there, I interviewed a mother, right? And so I've been a lawyer for a while now, and I thought, okay, you know, I can handle it.
Okay.
Except if, and I would imagine none of you have been to a prison, and I hope you never will. But a prison is not the most fun place to be, nor is it the most welcoming, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was interviewing a mother who was talking to me about the hardships that she had suffered in her home country, and she was there with two kids. She was there with a 6-year-old, and she was there with a 2-year-old. And we were in a room, so if you could picture what this looks like, right? We're in a room that's 5 feet by 7 feet. So if you can imagine, like, I think one of these blocks here on the floors are five. Is this a foot on the floor?
Yeah, these are 1 foot.
One of these.
So
five of these and then seven, right? So you can calculate in your mind what that looks like. And there was no toys. And the little boy, the 6-year-old, came in with a matchbox car. And the 2-year-old had a little tiny Iron Man, like one of those little toys. And the kids, while I'm talking to mom about an assault that she had suffered, in front of her kids, she's saying this story while the two kids are in the corner of this cement block room with linoleum floors and nothing to play with, trying to make a game out of the matchbox car and the Iron Man. That broke my heart. And that night I remember I called Roberto and I started to cry, and I'm like, I was gonna be there for a week. I'm like, I can't be here for a week. I don't know how I'm gonna do this for a week. To sit here and time again, listen to the stories that we had to listen to. And the guards treated these women and their kids like they were trash. I remember on another day I was meeting with this woman, and supposedly they had daycares for the kids. So the woman leaves the kid at the daycare, and I'm interviewing mom about her asylum case. And the guard, now lawyers have confidentiality, right? So when you talk to a lawyer, anything you say is confidential. You can't just barge in. You got to knock on the door. Well, this officer barged into the room, and she's screaming at my client, "You left your kid in daycare, and you got to go get your kid." And I looked at the guard, and I'm like, number one, we're in the middle of an interview. Number two, you can't keep this kid? This woman is telling me a story that her kid should not be listening to. And I'm not going to be there that long. Not only that, but I couldn't, because there were only certain hours that I could go and visit. It was heartbreaking. It was infuriating.
I've cried. I've had a situation where it literally brought me to tears. I had back in the 90s, there was a company in New Bedford that had a bunch of undocumented workers. They were making backpacks for the military. That's what they did here. And then the company was raided one day, and 200, I believe it was about 300 men and women, mostly women, were taken out, and they literally disappeared. I mean, they were put on buses and sent to prisons all around the country, and nobody knew for the next week or so where they were. One of the mothers had a young child, and the father came to my office asking for help finding the mother. While he was in the office with the child was crying, wouldn't stop crying. And I said to him, Why is your baby crying? What's wrong? And he says, well, he's still suckling. He's still, you know, feeding on the mom. And there's nothing worse than to all of a sudden stop a kid from feeding from the mother's breast at that age. The kid won't eat anything else. I mean, that's a process that has to be done over time. And that literally, you know, broke my heart.
You said you said you couldn't stand to be there for X amount of time, right? Is that?
I didn't think I could, but I had to.
So there's got to be a difficulty for people who are sympathetic to those detainees to be there on a full-time basis, regularly, to support them, to be advocates for them, or to even be the guards and work the process from the inside. It's difficult. They can't maintain that position. So I would imagine that the people who can maintain that position are probably, and I don't want to make, you know, assumptions, but probably people maybe with less sympathy, right? Because that's one of the requirements to be around it so often.
I think eventually when you work in a system where all you see is despair and heartache, you eventually distance yourself from that situation and you become hardened, right? You become...
When I saw...
It's no longer shocking.
There was
it's kind of like the shootings, right? How many shootings? We had the first shooting in 1998 in Oakland.
Columbine.
We were all up in arms, and now there's shootings every day, and people are like, oh, it's just another shooting. And I don't want to minimize that. I'm not trying to do that, but it's that sort of feeling I think that people get with the idea of family separation and what we're doing to immigrants.
When I saw the protests at the Wyatt, so right in, it's in Rhode Island, there were protests, and when I saw the guard take his very large truck, not a regular, you know, pickup, he had like one of the like extra, and try to run people over to get to his parking spot, like with intent.
He did.
So yeah, like he physically hit people with his vehicle to get to his. So I'm thinking, if this person has this level of empathy for other humans, like what's going on when that same person
is inside?
Right? Like with these people. We are going to have on as our guest in just a few weeks. We've rescheduled it around, but Jessica Vega has been an advocate in that community. And we'll be able to ask her more questions about that. What was your question?
It's for the both of you. I actually kind of want to know how you guys met and like how, you know.
Say the word.
Y'all fell in love.
How'd you guys
fall in love? Rob definitely put them up to this question.
Did not.
No.
We genuinely asked.
Did you genuinely ask that question?
Yeah. I personally would like to know. I think it would be sweet.
So I, as you can tell, I think, you know, am much younger than Roberto.
He's pretty young
himself. Boy, man, you got a bromance going on.
Not in spirit.
I'm not saying that. I mean, he's looked pretty young.
You know it's she's talking about chronological age. She's not talking about
how he feels.
Spiritual age?
Spiritual age.
You're going to have to school me on that later.
So I started working with Roberto. I was very young. I was right fresh out of high school, really. I think I was 19 when we met. And he was obviously old. He was already a lawyer. I was not. And he became a really good friend. He is a good guy. And so, at the time, I was dating somebody else. I ended up getting married and everything. But I married for reasons that I shouldn't have, right? And someone said, what could you tell your 16-year-old self is, you know, don't marry your high school boyfriend. Like, don't do that. It's not going to work out. Not going to work out. Trust me when I tell you. So I married my high school boyfriend, and I probably shouldn't have done that. And, you know, Roberto was always the one that was there for me to kind of, you know, to talk me through it. I also did not go to college right after high school because of my high school boyfriend. So again, don't marry the high school boyfriend. It's not a good idea. And I always regretted that, right? I think I always, in my mind, always resented that. And I would talk about it. And Roberto always encouraged me. You got to go back to college. You got so much potential. You could do this. I believe in you. You should believe in you. And we became, I think, each other's confidants and best friends. You know, he had issues that he was going through, and he would talk to me about them. And, you know, the workday would end, and we would spend hours after work just talking about life, about whatever, just talking. And eventually I divorced, he divorced, and, you know, it was one of those, like, we should go to dinner. And, You know, started with the dinner.
In my head, I'm thinking, you're divorced, I'm divorced, you're single, I'm single, let's get
married. Hey, yeah.
Well, the, you know.
Marriage came way later, right? You guys.
Marriage came way later, yeah.
So you, that's what I thought about
so
in
you
my
fell
head.
In love with your best friend?
Yeah.
That's cute.
I think that's that was what made our relationship so strong.
Because you started off as friends.
When we're
first.
Best friends before we became lovers and and that kind of thing. I think it makes for a stronger relationship. Yeah. And by the way, I don't agree with Debbie on the not all high school relationships fail.
Okay, thank you.
How did your high school relationship go?
Mine
didn't. Yeah, I don't. But I know people that know each other from high school and are still, very much together. I think it's more a factor of is there understanding, is there consideration, for each other,
So just don't not do something for yourself because you're trying to consider the other person. Because at the end of the day, you need to be number one. Because if you're not number one for you, no one's going to make you number one.
But apparently you can grow together too, because the dad that I had growing up is a very different dad that I have now. And there's definitely been some influence. For example, the holidays, my dad was the bah humbug guy, right? Like, well, gifts. We ain't got time for gifts. You want to say it hasn't changed, right? Is that what you're thinking right now?
Changed.
Okay, but hold on. When I saw a Christmas card from your family with him in the middle doing this Justin Bieber heart, I was like, who the F are you? Who is this guy? He's been replaced. Aliens have come and taken my dad. Like, that was you were the alien that came and took my dad.
Every relationship requires compromise.
Right.
At the end of our podcast.
Really? You compromised the heart? Like, you didn't want to do that?
I'm not saying the heart, but, the Christmas card.
Well, you've compromised, too, because my dad is notoriously evil in the kitchen, about the kitchen. The kitchen is his space. Everything has to be a certain way. My dad organizes
the garbage
before you can put it in the garbage.
Like, you can't touch the garbage.
If you take garbage and put, not recyclables, if you take garbage and put garbage in the garbage, you're wrong.
Yes.
Oh my God.
You messed up.
No, that's okay. Why
yeah, I had no, you have to put all the plates, the paper plates together, and they have to be in a nice stack, and they have to be cleaned off before you put them
in the garbage.
So is the kitchen like his baby? Like,
is the kitchen your baby? Explain this to us.
So he's the cleaner. I do the cooking and I mess up the kitchen, which is nice because I like that because I like cooking. And then he comes in and he makes it spick and span so that I can go back in and make a mess.
Can we eat at your house?
Anytime.
And on the weekends, it's literally, all day we do.
Stepmom.
I don't think he's kicking it to my stepmom. I don't know. That's not the vibe that I caught. I hope that this is true for all of you. I hope that, time is tough. Like, he's going through law school, all that stuff. I got a chance to be closer with my dad afterward, right? Like, in my adulthood. And I hope that you guys get even closer to your parents in adulthood. But then sometimes you'll realize that some things change and some things don't. I spent some time with him in Puerto Rico recently. And I'm thinking everything's good. We have a great relationship now. It was different when I was a kid. But, man, when it came to the kitchen, like, I forgot. Like, I did the dishes. And I do dishes good. But it was not good enough. Like, there was something, like, I didn't put the sponge in the right place or something like that. And I started getting
PTSD.
Yeah, like, I started, like, going back to childhood. I was like, no. And I hid from them for 3 days in Puerto Rico. That was
he yelled funny. Your whole government name when you did something wrong.
Yeah, that's things. We do shout-outs on the end of our podcast. So this shout-out, we're starting to evolve the shout-out. So if you want to give a shout-out to somebody that you're working with or somebody that we should check out, for example, during this podcast, I started thinking, if we wanted to continue this conversation, we should probably talk to Amor, and I know some really cool people at Amor. So what shout-outs would you give, and who do you think this group needs to have on this podcast now that you've done it?
So I'm going to shout out the Immigrant Coalition of Rhode Island.
Immigrant Coalition of Rhode Island,
so
okay.
The Immigrant Coalition is a coalition of about 35 NGOs, so non-governmental agencies, meaning that they're all nonprofit too, that are doing really fabulous work. Some of the agencies within the coalition, Roger Williams Immigration Clinic, which is where I work, the Rhode Island Center for Justice, the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, Amor, Never Again, the Rhode Island Coalition of Interfaith, or it's the Interfaith Coalition of Rhode Island or something along those lines. Progreso Latino, Fuerza Laboral, Dorcas International. So all of these organizations have come together after the Trump administration took office. And we've done significant amount of work. One of the things that we did was we passed or got helped pass legislation last year so that kids who had DACA, right, deferred action, meaning kids who were undocumented but had deferred action even after the deferred action expired and they can no longer get it, can continue to get their driver's licenses. So we were able to get that done. This year we're working on driver's licenses for all again. We raised money so that when the Trump administration ended DACA, that we would pay the filing fees for students who needed to apply for DACA. We raised, I want to say it was $100,000 for those filing fees alone. And then last year or 2 years ago, we raised $250,000 so that we could hire a lawyer and a coordinator of the coalition. And so I want to give them a shout out, because without this group of people coming together, a lot of the work wouldn't be done that's being done for the immigrant population in Rhode Island.
And you?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of lawyer groups that are out there doing a lot of positive work, including our local chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, taking on difficult cases and bringing them all the way up through the federal court, suing immigration for things like, you know, not allowing our Muslim brothers to come into this country. Things like unlawful detentions of immigrants, prolonged detention, you know, where you can keep someone in prison forever without giving them a fair trial. And then there's a group that I belong to, the ACLU, the Civil Liberties group, but also the American Immigration Lawyer Association is doing some great work. You know, they go out and, you know, monitor what's going on at the airports when immigrants are coming in from other parts of the world and help people, and they defend people in court every day. Now, mind you, a lot of these are lawyers that get paid, but a lot of them are lawyers that work for nonprofits, and although they may get paid, they don't get paid a lot of money.
If you don't mind, bear with me for just 2 seconds after so that we can take a group photo. My email address is there. I will explain more to you why I put that up there in just a second. So I want to close on a student like Sylvia. What are the next steps for a student like Sylvia? What should Sylvia be thinking about right now for her obvious passion, and if she wanted to turn it into a career path?
So what grade are you in, Sylvia?
I'm a junior.
Junior. So you want to start thinking about internships for the summer. Maybe get an internship at a law firm that might be hiring for you to do some law work. You know, maybe you want to think about that. You want to be thinking about getting into a college that's going to prepare you well. Any background, law school is definitely where you want to be. Roger Williams University, I'm there. Apply for the immigration clinic. I'll be happy to see you there representing some clients.
This has been another Steambox podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Steambox Versus is the podcast. Please follow us at SteamboxRI. So all of my steampunks from Highlander, Roberto and Deb Gonzalez, please say deuces.
Deuces. Deuces.